From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Will the 2004-2005 NHL season be put on ice, or will the league and its players cool out in time to keep the Zambonis running? Ahead on Only a Game, a conversation with Helene Elliott, a report from Dallas on the Stars' plan to foster goodwill via the reduction of ticket prices, and the straight dope on the Boston indoor game. Also ahead, members of the 1980 U.S. hockey team discuss the Hollywood version of their Miracle on Ice.
Monumental events don't come along that often. And 20-some-odd years later, to be sitting and watching a movie, and here it is. And the event has legs. It has legs.
Stay tuned.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Noor Rahm. Voters in Michigan and Washington state cast ballots today in Democratic presidential caucuses. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Michigan's caucuses represent one of the biggest prizes of this early political season, with 128 delegates to the Democratic National Convention at stake. Another 76 delegates will be awarded in Washington. Together, the two states account for almost 10% of the delegates needed to secure the party's nomination. Both John Kerry and Howard Dean campaigned this week in Michigan, where jobs are a major concern. The state has lost some 185,000 factory jobs over the last 4 years. John Edwards and Wesley Clark are, for the most part, looking beyond this weekend's contest. They're hoping for strong showings Tuesday in the southern border states of Virginia and Tennessee. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Nashville.
The U.S. and its major economic allies wrap up 2 days of talks today in Boca Raton, Florida. The so-called Group of Seven is made up of the U.S., Japan, Germany, France, Britain, Italy, and Canada. Representatives have been discussing the steep decline in the value of the dollar worldwide and the growing trade and budget deficits in the United States. Monday, U.S. officials announced that the U.S. budget deficit will reach $521 billion, a record high. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld is in Munich today attending the annual Security Summit. Yesterday, he ordered a review of allegations by U.S. servicewomen in Iraq and Kuwait that they were sexually assaulted by U.S. servicemen. NPR's Eric Westervelt reports.
Secretary Rumsfeld has ordered the Pentagon to conduct a detailed review of the effectiveness of the Defense Department's programs on preventing and handling sexual assaults. The review comes in the wake of at least 80 allegations of sexual misconduct by U.S. servicemen against female soldiers in Iraq and Kuwait. A Pentagon spokesman traveling with the secretary here in Germany for a security conference said the review will take 90 days, but he said changes will be made before that deadline if investigators discover that reforms are needed. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, at the International Security Summit in Munich.
Officials in Thailand said today they'd hope to end Thailand's last bird flu outbreak within the next 2 days. Thailand is the fourth largest chicken exporter in the world. The virus has struck 10 countries and killed 18 people. Agriculture officials in Delaware have ordered the killing of 12,000 chickens today after discovering the presence of a strain of avian influenza. They say the disease is not the same as one is affecting humans in Asia and poses no risk to human health. They wouldn't identify the owner of the chickens or their location. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Prison officials in Arizona are putting new security measures into place following a 15-day hostage situation there. They've acknowledged there were lapses that allowed guards to be taken captive. Mark Moran of member station KJZZ reports from Phoenix.
The hostage situation began when two inmates used metal shanks to overpower a corrections officer. One of the inmates then put on an officer's uniform and got the pair into a tower in the center of the prison yard and took two hostages, a male and a female. The man was held for a week. The female officer was held for 15 days. Shortly after her release, officials said there was evidence that she had been sexually assaulted while being held captive. The fact that the inmates were able to enter the tower during the standoff, which was thought to be stocked with weapons, is considered a major security breakdown. Director of the state's corrections department says there will be a top-to-bottom investigation to make sure similar incidents can't happen again. For NPR News, I'm Mark Moran in Phoenix.
Law enforcement officials in Ohio say they've confirmed another shooting related to a series of highway sniper attacks. They say the windshield of a van was struck by a bullet this week on Interstate 71, about 15 miles from where several other attacks have occurred. The latest case brings the total number of shootings to 21 since last May. One person was killed. Officials say they expect to reopen the Seaway International Bridge today, connecting Ontario and New York. The border was closed yesterday after a shooting on the Canadian side. Authorities say a man with an assault rifle opened fire near a customs building. No one was hurt. Officials say they don't think the customs building was the target. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kresge Foundation, building capacity with challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The NHL's All-Star Weekend is here, but the luster of the skills competition, the parties, and the game itself has been diminished by the real possibility there will be no All-Star Game a year from now, because there may be no 2004-2005 season. So we once again call upon the LA Times salary cap swami, Helene Elliott, who often doubles as Only a Game's puck talk princess of the plexiglass. She joins us from St. Paul, Minnesota, the site of this year's All-Star Game. Helene, welcome back.
How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Now, we spoke to you as the National Hockey League season began, and we discussed attempts by the NHL Players Association and the league to convene and begin negotiating on various key issues about a year before the deadline for the new collective bargaining agreement. What's been going on recently in those negotiations?
So what's the matter? You never call anymore.
sound like my mother.
There you go. I'd like to be able to say that there's been progress, or as they say in Canada, progress, but there really hasn't been. I think what the essence of it is this, is that the NHL wants to get a salary cap. The NHL Players Association has said very vehemently that they will not take a salary cap in any shape or form, or whatever the NHL may want to call it, cost control or circuit breaker or whatever other euphemisms they use. They say they are equally adamant against accepting that. So we're at a standoff right now.
Well, is it a standoff we're doomed to endure, or will there be further discussions during the second half of the regular season?
Well, human nature being what it is and people tending to be procrastinators, I suspect that there will be a buildup of pressure once we get into the spring and summer. The collective bargaining agreement expires September 15th, so I think that we'll see negotiations really get in earnest maybe September 14th. That's just the way it is. I mean, we saw that with the baseball negotiations, that there has to be some kind of threat of, you know, midnight and the witching hour and all that. That does tend to spur people to become serious sometimes, but there really does seem to be a huge philosophical gap here. And I honestly am thinking at this point that there will not be a season next year.
The Players Association has said that it will not accept any kind of linkage between salaries and team revenues because the Players Association doesn't trust the math that the league has presented. Is there a reason for this mistrust?
Absolutely. Just taking for an example the Kings, whose situation I've written about extensively, each team is supposed to list its revenues from various sources, from tickets, from broadcast rights, from concessions, from parking, et cetera, et cetera. Well, in their report, the Kings don't list the revenues that they get from Laker tickets because the owner of the Kings also owns a portion of the Lakers. So, you know, you're talking about they're listing what's in their left pocket, but not what's in their right pocket. And in the end, it's all commingled. It's all, you know, one big fund, one big pot. But as long as you can have creative accountants, there's going to be a lot of big discrepancies.
The league, on the other hand, maintains that business simply cannot continue under the present system, and the league has assembled a tome with graphs and pie charts. It looks like the weekend edition of USA Today. Have you seen that book, and does it make any sort of a convincing case?
I think the people it helps most are the copying stores who get to put them into those nice little binders with the little plastic gazoos that, you know, keep all the pages together. I've seen all those graphs. I've seen all those pages. I've seen all their numbers. And again, if you know any accountants, I'm sure that they will tell you, you can make numbers sing and dance and talk and say pretty much whatever you want them to, and you can do that legally in most cases. You can say, well, it's all going to one owner, it's all going to one person, but they're listing, say, the Kings paying rent for the arena that they own. And it's absurd. You know, Joe Fan and Jane Fan are sitting there and going, what I want to know is there going to be hockey next season?
Well, then you're on the record as saying you think there may very well not be. Maybe we ought to concentrate on this season, talk a little bit about the All-Star game. What do fans have to look forward to at the spectacle?
You know, it's unfortunate, but I think in most leagues, the All-Star games have become more of a corporate and sponsorship thing than a fan thing. But, you know, there will be some things to look forward to. And I think in hockey, the one thing is when you've got a guy like a Rick Nash from the Columbus Blue Jackets, I mean, this is a star of the future. This is a guy who's going to be carrying the league in the future. And Nash is supposed to play in the Young Stars game. And it's always exciting to get a look at those kids and get to know them. And you sit back and say, oh, I remember when he played in his first All-Star game in 2004. And you really get an emotional involvement.
More pressure than ever, perhaps, on this next question, since there may be no next season. Talk to me about the second half of this season. Which teams should we be looking at as the next couple of months roll by?
Well, you know, it's been interesting in the East to see some teams who have played very well lately, particularly those Boston Bruins there.
There you go.
This Raycroft kid, my goodness, wow, the goalie has just been terrific. That's been a pleasant surprise. The Montreal Canadiens have played with a lot of kids in their lineup. They cleared out some of their older guys. I think Bob Gainey coming in there as an executive has really brought an air of tradition and good hockey judgment into that organization. You know, in the West, it's just a complete scramble from the five on down to the nine. There's only a couple of points separating all those teams. The Kings have just done an incredible job given all the injuries that they've had. They've missed so many of their key players for either all of the season or good chunks of the season, and it's just pretty near miraculous that they've been able to stay in the playoff race with what's basically a minor league lineup on most nights. So there are some pretty good storylines going down the rest of the season.
Helene Elliott is the L.A. Times aristocrat of the super tax and revenue-sharing rock on tour for Only a Game. Thank you, Helene.
Thank you.
The troika of inevitability, death, taxes, and the constant cost increase of tickets to professional sporting events took a hit recently when the National Hockey League's Dallas Stars looked reality in the eye and blinked, giving its fans a rare break. Glenn Mitchell has the story.
A 5-minute major for charging and a game misconduct at $159.
Want to see the Stars play at the new American Airlines Center on a season ticket? It's going to cost you, but next year it could cost substantially less. The Stars won the Stanley Cup in 1999, but have recently seen a mild drop in season ticket buyers. Economic considerations and potential NHL labor trouble next year have led the team to do what most franchises in any sport would never contemplate. They're lowering the cost of thousands of seats from $90 on a season ticket basis to $65, and increasing the number of $65 tickets already available, most in the desirable so-called lower bowl. They're also dropping some prices in the upper deck. Brian Perez is the Stars' Executive Vice President of Marketing and Communications.
We announced it a lot earlier than we have in the past because, you know, given the uncertainty about next year, our goal was to be as upfront and honest with our fan base as early as we could. So we did the analysis earlier based on the trends we had already seen this year and tried to give them a little clearer picture of what was going to happen next year and in the playoffs. We've built payrolls up to a point where our revenues can't keep up with the cost structure. And without those significant national revenues that the other leagues enjoy, it's got to come from ticket prices. And just fans can't do it anymore. Mm-hmm. And we figured that out, and so we're getting out in front of it.
That uncertainty is coming thanks to a brewing storm in the NHL, a battle over how revenues should be shared that could scuttle next season. Mark Brender is a senior writer for the Hockey News.
If they lower it now, it's kind of like you're stemming a bit of the or getting some goodwill that you may need after some potential labor problems, and to encourage people to sign up and get season tickets now while they can, where next year people might not be willing to fork out the money if they don't know that there's going to be hockey next year, given the labor situation. And as well, you know, if the Stars do unload some of their pricey talent, this may be an encouragement or a bit of a payback for fans, saying, you know, we have to do this for budgetary reasons, but here's what we're doing for you to try to encourage you to keep coming and supporting the team.
The central question over the economic health of the league, Brender says, is one that's hotly disputed. Players argue that if some teams are making money, owners need to share revenues more equitably, and that will solve the problem. Owners, on the other hand, want a hard link between revenues and expenses, either a salary cap or a fixed percentage of revenues going to players. But even as the dispute creates uncertainty for next season, the prospect for cheaper season tickets is playing well in Dallas. At a recent Stars home game, most fans agreed they'd attend more games if season prices came down.
Absolutely.
Because it's cheaper.
Absolutely. I mean, if they're going to drop the price on these tickets, for these seats, you can't beat the price. It's a great seat. You can see all the ice. You only lose about 5% of the ice on these seats. You can't beat it. We used to be a season ticket holder. Now we just buy by the game. But if they drop the price, I'd definitely be a season ticket holder again next year.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think you reach a bigger audience anytime you drop price.
The Stars' Brian Perez agrees it's simply market forces at work. In the NHL, where many teams have NFL-sized payrolls but only a tiny percentage of pro football's TV revenues, the team says it's just listening to the fans.
We knew the fans were out there. We knew with the economy and everything else that's going on and where ticket prices has gone that we needed to lower them to get back in. They basically spoke with their wallets.
But while other teams are offering various kinds of discount deals in the face of bad economics or losing seasons, Dallas, says the Hockey News' Mark Brender, is in the vanguard of price dropping for perhaps a different reason.
I think it's a different deal in Dallas, where the Stars have been very popular and having success at the box office. That's a little rare, but it may be prepping the way, so to speak, for some big salary dumping after this season. They already got rid of Darian Hatcher, and there's going to be more to come because the Stars have the most money committed to next year in payroll of any team in the NHL. That could cause them some problems, and I think that may be what we're seeing here with the Stars.
The potential labor problems won't affect this season, but the collective bargaining agreement expires in September, in plenty of time to ice next year's season. For Only a Game, this is Glenn Mitchell in Dallas.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. Getting fit has perhaps never been as much fun as it is these days in London. An establishment there called Gymbox is offering what trainers call the shag workout, and participants have said their sex lives have, quote, vastly improved as a result. Classes focus on tantric techniques and work targeted areas of the body in specific ways. One Gymbox spokesman has said, quote, once inhibitions have been lowered and specific muscles targeted, 25% of women participants in the test classes have reported experiencing, end quote, a delightful time, time after time.
I'm Bob C. with these sports headlines. In yesterday's women's college basketball action, Texas Christian topped Tulane 76-44, and Houston beat Southern Miss 70-56. On the men's side, it was Ivy League night, as Yale vanquished Columbia 63-58, Cornell bested Brown 96-81, Princeton downed Dartmouth 61-45, and Pennsylvania halted Harvard 104-69. In non-Ivy League games, Colgate enjoyed a 75-66 laugher over Lafayette. High Point scored 81 points to Charlotte Southern's tally of 78. Troy State beat Georgia State 85-69. And St. Peter's rode Ryder to a 77-69 loss. For Only a Game, I'm Bob C. in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, one heavily recruited gridiron gourmand offers reviews of restaurants in Gainesville, Tallahassee, Auburn, and Miami. But first, last night during the Millrose Games at Madison Square Garden, Marion Jones returned to competition for the first time in 16 months. She won the 60 meters in 7.21 seconds and said, "I'm back where I belong." But much of the focus during the week leading up to the event hasn't been on how Ms. Jones would run or even her experiences as a first-time mom. Attention has been paid instead to the latest in a long string of doping scandals to rack the world of track and field. Only a Game's Karen Given has our report.
On the match stretch, ladies and gentlemen, Jen Toomey.
Runner Jen Toomey takes a victory lap after easily winning the 800 meters at last weekend's Boston Indoor Games. As she accepts handshakes and congratulations from the crowd, she's not thinking about the doping controversy. In fact, she's happy to see attempts to clean up track and field making the news.
As a person who works really hard and who does it the honest way, when they can catch someone, I think it's great. So I love that they're putting the spotlight on it. I know it seems like a lot of negative publicity, but the more publicity, I hope that the more that they could do to catch people who are cheating.
It seems in track and field, every athlete has developed a strategy to deal with doping. Toomey tries not to think about it. Sprinter John Capel has a more unorthodox approach.
To me, when I heard about all those guys that were, all the people that were on the drugs and stuff like that, trying to make themselves better, I took it as a challenge. Because if you scared enough of me to darn and try to end your life to beat me, I feel good about myself. So if you want to take a needle and stick it up in your butt to try to beat me, then go ahead. I'll help you put it in there.
Capel's assertion notwithstanding, the Chicago Tribune's Philip Hirsch doesn't expect this latest controversy to have much of an effect on the sport. He's been covering Olympic sports and track and field for a quarter of a century.
One of the good or bad things about track and field in the United States, depending on your perspective, is that nobody pays much attention to it except during those 17 days of the Olympics. So a lot of the people who come to watch the Olympics will be totally unaware of what's happened since Sydney in 2000.
Here's the alphabet soup of what's happened since Sydney. Days after the games ended, out-of-competition testing for all Olympic sports was handed over to the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, or USADA, while the International Track Federation investigated concerns that USA Track and Field, or USATF, might have covered up doping positives. Citing athlete confidentiality, USATF refused to release documents concerning one of those cases, the 1999 acquittal of Sydney gold medal sprinter Jerome Young, until last Sunday, when the organization bowed to pressure from the United States Olympic Committee. Meanwhile, last October, USADA announced what it called the largest drug bust in Olympic sports. Four track and field athletes had tested positive for THG, a previously undetectable designer steroid. A federal grand jury was convened to investigate Balco, the company suspected of making the drug. And last month, President Bush even made the issue part of his State of the Union address.
So tonight I call on team owners, union representatives, coaches, and players to take the lead, to send the right signal, to get tough, and to get rid of steroids now.
Philip Hirsch is quick to assert that Olympic sports, including track and field, are a great deal cleaner than professional sports in this country. Still, Marion Jones, arguably track's most recognized current star, hasn't escaped the controversy. Jones has been dogged by rumors since high school, but in the past year or so, she's been called to testify in the investigation into Balco and associated with Charlie Francis, the coach who admitted to supervising the doping of Canadian sprinter Ben Johnson. Troubling developments for Hirsch.
Has Marion Jones ever tested positive? No. But has she been very, very close to a lot of doping scandals or doping incidents? Yes. And does that mean that it's a little bit harder to take everything that she does at face value? In her case, it is. And sadly enough, it's in the case of virtually everybody in track and field that it's hard to take what anybody does at face value. The clean people can't prove that they're clean, and the guilty people are too rarely caught.
For his part, USATF CEO Craig Masbach says track and field has caught more athletes than other sports, not because more athletes are cheating, but because the organization is more serious about catching them. Still, Masbach admits the system hasn't been perfect.
All drug testing programs dating back to the 1980s, and track and field was one of the first to have them, have their shortcomings historically. I think on balance, looking back to the late 80s and early 90s and to vestiges of that system that continued even to the year 2000, we may have been overprotective of the confidentiality rights of athletes. But I can certainly assure you that there is no evidence that any test was ever covered up, that anyone who tested positive did not go through our system.
In the wake of the THG positives, in December, track and field announced a lifetime ban for first-time steroid offenders. But the newly approved bylaw came under legal scrutiny before it was even passed, when it had to be amended to stipulate the lifetime ban only applies if it doesn't violate the Amateur Sports Act. For good measure, the author then listed the provision of the Sports Act the bylaw likely violates. Still, Masbach says he hopes the lifetime ban will be enforceable.
We won't really know until the first athlete tests positive and we attempt to impose the life ban, at which point we assume that the athlete will challenge that and the courts will decide.
Blood chemistry and court arbitration didn't seem to matter to the standing room only crowd of 4,000 at last Saturday's Boston Indoor Games. At least one of those fans, Charlene Kohler-Britton, has heard enough about the controversy.
The climate of this kind of like catch somebody doing something awful, when I think these athletes train so very, very hard to do such a good job. And I really don't like this witch hunt mentality that I've been seeing lately. I think for the most part, track and field is a really clean sport, very, very hardworking athletes, and I'm really dismayed about seeing it being raked over the coals like so many other areas of the public life at this point.
Track and Field's indoor tour makes its next stop in Fayetteville, Arkansas on Valentine's Day. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Willie Williams has not yet finished high school, but he has been accustomed to steak and lobster dinners and to traveling by private jet. That's because some of the most successful college football programs in the country have regarded Williams as the linebacker who can help carry them to the national championship, and they courted him energetically in the weeks leading up to signing day, which was Wednesday. Miami Herald writer Manny Navarro has been chronicling the recruiting of Willie Williams this winter. He joins me now from his home in Miami. Mr. Navarro, welcome to Only a Game.
Well, thank you for having me.
Your January 13th story on Willie Williams begins with Mr. Williams visiting the Florida State campus via a private jet. His only companions were the flight attendant and the pilot. Was this unusual?
Well, believe it or not, you know, the big-time star recruits definitely do get this sort of treatment when they visit programs like Florida State, Florida, Miami. Private jets are definitely not a rare thing.
At dinner that night during that visit, Willie's initially intimidated by the prices of the steak and lobster tails, and then he says, quote, "I saw what the other guys were ordering, and I was like, forget this. I called the waiter back and told him to bring me 4 lobster tails, 2 steaks, and a shrimp scampi." Would any behavior at that table that evening have been considered excessive by Willie's hosts?
No. I've spoken to more than not Willie about trips like these, and for a lot of kids, they've never been to these restaurants. They've never been to a place that has steak and lobster. They're used to the McDonald's and the Burger Kings and steak and lobster, and basically to be told, you know, you can eat anything you want on the menu, well, they take it that way.
When Willie visits the University of Miami a couple of weeks later, Coach Larry Coker picks him up in a Cadillac Escalade, puts him up in the Paradise Suite at the Mayfair Hotel, where Mr. Williams has a jacuzzi on his balcony. What, if anything, has all this to do with playing football and going to college?
You know, that's a good question. You know, they're really trying to show these kids, we really want you. Mm-hmm. You know, I think all of them know when they have a kid come into town, they want to take him to the best restaurants. They want to say to them, hey, we really want you. We really want you to come here. And so everybody's just trying to sort of top one another, and that's what comes of these trips.
At dinner one night during that University of Miami visit, Coach Coker orders for Willie. And as Willie says, quote, he was like, I've been reading up on you. Did any of the details of these recruiting visits surprise you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, some of it was just flat out funny. You know, Willie compared Coach Coker to Cleo, the fortune teller, I guess.
The mind reader, yeah.
The mind reader. And, you know, these guys do their homework. They know what these kids like to eat. I'm sure Coker read about Willie's trip to Florida State and Florida. They're all on top of this. They know what's going on, and they knew they had to show Willie a real good time.
Was there one particular story in your ongoing conversations with Willie that just blew you away, that just had you laughing so hard you had to stop typing?
I think when he went to Bobby Bowden's house at Florida State, and when he talked about, you know, getting the desserts and saying how it looked like a bakery.
This is the coach's wife making
the
all these wonderful desserts.
And he
desserts.
Said, you know, Ms. Bowden was the bomb. That was real funny. I had to stop the tape recorder and just laugh because Willie just had a way of putting things and taking you into a place where he was. And he was so detailed with everything. And he was just great.
On Wednesday, Willie Williams announced that he would play football at the University of Miami. That was his decision. And that evening, the news broke that three separate criminal complaints had been sworn out against him while he was visiting the University of Florida. Do you suppose the coaching staff at the University of Florida was just as happy that Willie had chosen Miami?
Well, I can tell you Ron Zook basically said, you know, he kind of wished Willie wouldn't have come at all after that. I definitely think if Willie gets through this and he's able to play college football, I'm sure Ron Zook wouldn't have minded having him on the team.
At least one of these legal issues, one of the complaints that was filed, had to do with a woman that he hugged in a hotel. But there are lots of stories in these recruiting visits about girls and women, you know, with these players. This seems to me a very kind of shadowy area as far as showing a kid how much you want him to be there.
Well, I mean, Willie's isn't the only recruit that's told me about girls being around on these trips. It just seems to me that these guys, these recruiters know when these kids come to town, you show them a college girl, that's definitely going to stimulate their interest a little more. And I guess these recruiters are sort of hoping, well, maybe that'll swing his thoughts and maybe the girls will impress him enough and that'll be something else that he weighs in his decision-making process.
Manny, if you go back, say a year from now, to talk to Willie again, what do you think the odds are that he'll say, yeah, this is great, it's lived up to my expectations, and what are the odds that he says, oh boy, I was really misled, I thought this was going to be terrific, and it's just a grind?
I think Willie knows what he got himself into at UM. He knows he's not going to be eating steak and lobster every day. He knows it was just part of that one experience. But in watching other kids in his situation go to the University of Miami, I've never come across one that said, this situation stinks. It wasn't what they told me it was. Mm-hmm. I think most of them got a real clear understanding of what the lunches are going to be like, what the dinners are going to be like. It's not going to be steak and lobster by any means.
All right. Are you going to be a Willie Williams fan henceforth, at least for the next 4 or 5 years?
Well, I hope so. I hope he gets to play college football. We'll see how dire the situation is in Gainesville. And I think he's a kid that has had a troubled past. He'd been arrested 10 times as a juvenile, and that he was on probation, I guess, for burglary when he was 17 years old. He was treated as an adult. I hope for his sake that he can get past his life. I mean, he's one of these kids that comes out of a real rough neighborhood. All he knows is to do bad things. And, you know, his senior season, he sort of got his act together. He was ready to go to college, and then he had this bad weekend in Gainesville, and it could cost him.
Manny Navarro wrote the series on the recruiting of Willie Williams for the Miami Herald. Manny, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
You're listening to Only a Game. The Mail this week demonstrated once again that Only a Game listeners are suckers for great poetry, or at least for Super Bowl haiku, the 10th edition of which ran in last week's show. Jeff Harbison of Philadelphia, who listens to only a game on his computer, was among the listeners who wrote to express delight with the 10th edition of the feature. Richard Spears, who hears the program on WAMC in Albany, New York, responded in kind. I'm tired of it. God almighty, all in all, I'd rather watch Heidi. That screed arrived a day before the Super Bowl. Another disgruntled fellow, WBUR listener Peter Gerstein, emailed us just an hour before the game. He, too, had failed to contract Pat's fever. Both teams have virtually guaranteed that they're not going to score more than 21 points in the game, he wrote. The NFL has become the no-frills league due to enforced parity, no offense, and endless 16-14 games. Apparently, in the second half, both teams forgot that script. Michael Fishman, another WBUR listener, called the listener line to suggest that there was something missing from last week's conversation with Bernice Canner, author of The Super Bowl of Advertising, a chronicle of the advertising that has appeared on Super Bowl broadcasts.
You might have given at least a couple of words to the move-on ad, the ad that doesn't appear because CBS chose to be a censor with our airwaves.
That ad to which Mr. Fishman refers suggests that our children and their children will be paying for the current budget deficit. 2 weeks ago, Charlie Pierce and I did discuss the network's decision not to accept that commercial. By the way, after the Super Bowl halftime show, who can argue with CBS regarding matters of taste? Jeffrey Maurer, who hears only a game on WRVO in Syracuse, New York, emailed to say, the show appeals to me because it addresses the world of sports as a pleasant diversion, not a matter of life and death. Mr. Maurer remembers the days when major leaguers sold cars during the off-season. Apparently, he remembers them with some bitterness. He wrote, I read that Derek Jeter works out in the Bahamas all winter. What the bleep is that? Rome, New York got 24 inches of snow yesterday. I know. I shoveled it. You can email us your comments by visiting the website, onlyagame.org. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.vu.edu. We're located at WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Hotel Commonwealth Boston, located in the Fenway Park neighborhood, near historic mansions, universities, medical institutions, and cultural sites. Information at hotelcommonwealth.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Cub fans dance on Waveland Avenue.
Reverse the curse, rally time.
The Bulls basketball dynasty begins with a shot.
Here's Michael at the foul line. A shot on Elo. The Bulls win!
Can't come up with anything for the Blackhawks or White Sox at the moment. I'm Scott Simon. Tune in for Chicago sports and maybe sports from beyond. And, oh, right, we almost forgot the news on Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR News.
I'm Bob C. with these sports headlines. In yesterday's NBA action, Washington downed the Clippers 112-100. Indiana outpaced Toronto 83-77. New Orleans nullified Detroit 92-81. Memphis mauled Milwaukee 105-85. Portland beat Utah 87-73. Golden State topped Denver 96-87. And Atlanta bested Boston 100-96. Elsewhere, New Jersey debunked the Magic of Orlando by a score of 120-99. Minnesota prevailed over Cleveland 103-92. Houston edged Chicago 82-80. Seattle stopped Phoenix 107-105. and San Antonio stuffed Sacramento 102-94. For Only a Game, I'm Bob C. in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, veterans of the 1980 U.S. Olympic hockey team get to watch themselves win again. But first, just back from a one-week engagement at the Super Bowl, our analyst Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Thank you. I'll be back next year. Thank you. Tip your waiters and bartenders. Can I say hello?
Yes, absolutely.
To our fan Johnny Bindo Jr., who's living in some government housing down in Amarillo. Can I say thanks for writing and take care and be strong and
good luck.
Take care.
When we spoke with you last week, you acknowledged your disappointment with the dearth of declarative sentences in Houston, but you can't have had any complaints about the game itself, right?
No, it was just a terrific, terrific game. The most intriguing thing to me was the contrast between the two quarterbacks, mm-hmm. who had nothing in common except their ability to make gigantic plays. Tom Brady was a very efficient, very, very deserving of the MVP, but there was a lot of wahoo, yippee, in the way Jake DeLone played. It was without question the best game I've ever seen a quarterback play who didn't pass for 50%.
In the wake of the Janet Jackson Justin Timberlake incident,
what's that, Bill?
What?
What's that all about? I was getting lunch at halftime.
That's right. You were at the game. You probably didn't see Janet Jackson Justin Timberlake episode.
To be honest with you, I thought Kid Rock using the poncho for the flag was going to be the controversy.
That was the shocker.
Du jour, but little did I know.
In any case, the shocker to which I referred has Commissioner Tagliabue announcing that the league will change its policies. Do you care to speculate on the halftime entertainment for Super Bowl 39?
Excuse me. Up with people, up with people. I mean, they're all grandparents now. They must have some kids they can put in the yellow sweaters next year. I guarantee it.
The organizers of the opening ceremonies at the Athens Olympics have announced that there will be, quote, surprises associated with the entertainment there.
Look out!
Should we worry?
I don't know. I think that the NBA All-Star Game has already started to... One hesitates to say rejigger, but let's say it. Rejigger, it's halftime entertainment as a reaction to this. I think that you will see loud, noisy, tasteless production numbers, but not loud, noisy, tasteless, vulgar production numbers for a while.
In yet another related story, purists will avoid the annual haggis throwing competition in Melbourne this weekend because the competitors apparently will not be throwing real haggis. This is an outrage. Where does this end?
I don't understand. I mean, apparently haggis is too messy.
Yeah.
So what they're going to use, according to Ross Chudley, who's the coordinator of the Berwick Highlands Gathering, or probably the Berwick Highlands Gathering,
hoot,
they're going to use simulated haggis, which outside of wardrobe malfunction is my favorite phrase of the week.
This week, ESPN's Playmakers series was canceled, Charlie, after only one season, a controversial TV show which focused on the sometimes unseemly lives of pro football players won't be back, even though the ratings were very good. ESPN airs NFL games as well, and the controversy now, of course, centers on whether the show's cancellation constitutes censorship. What do you think?
And, of course, it does. The NFL said, we don't like this show. And
moving right along.
And ESPN said, thank you, sir. May I have another? My favorite quote, however, came from Ray Lewis, the Baltimore Ravens linebacker who had a little trouble with the law the other day, who said, that show don't mean nothing. That show is nothing about us, which is true. Nobody in the show was involved in a murder.
Maurice Clarett may very well have a future in the National Football League, and in the very near future. This week, a federal judge ruled that the NFL's rule barring Clarett from the draft violates the antitrust laws. Do you hear the rumble of barriers falling everywhere?
I think there's some barriers going to fall. I mean, the problem with the NFL draft vis-a-vis the antitrust laws of the country is the NFL draft has been and is always going to be a violation of those laws. And this is Maurice Clarett's the first person to take this argument to court. There is a serious argument to be made on the NFL's position in that there are players who are not physically ready to take the pounding. And you saw that more vividly, I think, in the Super Bowl than any other Super Bowl. People got really hurt in that game. But as far as the law itself, it appears to be on the side of the players.
In the topsy-turvy world of college hoops, there may be a new number one team or more than one new number one team this weekend due to Duke defeating UNC on the men's side on Thursday and the Connecticut women beating Tennessee and Knoxville the same night. Has this been, in your opinion, a more competitive season for both the men and women than we usually see?
No, I don't think so. I think the women's, you know, the women's top 10 is pretty much the same as the women's top 10 is every year. The men's top 5 has been a real kind of up and down thing. Duke is number one now for the third consecutive week, the first time any team has done that this year. The Super Bowl is now over, which is when and conference play has started, and you saw the great Duke-North Carolina game this week, and you saw Connecticut women go to Tennessee and just maul the home squad. So I think this, you know, the season has now gotten serious.
By the end of the month, perhaps we will be talking about the Texas Tech men's basketball team's prospects in the NCAA tournament. Certainly Tech coach Bob Knight hopes that that's what we're talking about at that point. But right now, the news in Lubbock is an outburst that led to Knight's not being suspended. Am I up to date on this?
I guess Chancellor David Smith of Texas Tech is very lucky that Coach Knight didn't pick up the produce counter and throw it at him. He got in the grill, as the young folks say, of his chancellor, the school then suspended him, then thought better of it and reprimanded him, meaning he gets off again. And by the way, folks in Lubbock, this is exactly how it started in Indiana. If you think this is an aberration, or this is going to be the last time he acts like a jackass, you haven't been following the career of your coach very closely.
On the pro basketball front, LeBron James is not an all-star unless he will be an all-star. What do you say, Commissioner?
He should be an all-star. Carmelo Anthony certainly should be an all-star. Carmelo Anthony should be in the running for most valuable player this year in the league. He won't get it, but he ought to be in the conversation. You know, the all-star game is for the fans. It's for people who want to watch. LeBron has had a marginal all-star season. That ought to be enough.
The protestations of such excellent golfers as Annika Sörenstam and Michelle Wee notwithstanding, Greg Norman said this week that he was ready to dismiss the participation of female golfers in the PGA Tour events as, quote, a marketing ploy. I wonder what the shark has against marketing.
I'm shocked to learn that Greg Norman, who sells everything but toaster ovens with a little tiny shark scribbled on the side, is suddenly objecting to marketing. Nick Faldo stepped up and said he wouldn't mind as long as the women could compete. I mean, these guys have to know that, you know, as Ned Beatty says in Network, they're messing with the fundamental forces of nature. If the sponsor wants Michelle Wee in your tournament, you're going to suck it up, Sally, and play with her.
It was announced this week that in June, some of the women who played in the WUSA will play in several pre-Olympic tournaments. League officials hope that this will provide a bridge to reconstituting the WUSA in the summer of 2005. I can't be objective on this one, as you well know. Do you think the WUSA has a future?
I hope it does, Bill, because it will make you very happy.
There you
go. I live to make you very happy. It will be interesting to see if they market these things as come to these tournaments and you'll get the WUSA back.
Pugilist Lennox Lewis announced his retirement yesterday. I can't say this with a straight face. How long before he announces he'll fight Butterbean, Larry Holmes, and John L. Sullivan?
Well, you know, I mean, it's 18 months till Riddick Bowe gets out of jail down in Maryland, so I'm sure the matchmaker. Look, there's no reason to believe any boxer retires until he's dead, and then only if you go to the funeral home and drive a stake in his heart.
Finally, Charlie, racers in Western Romania's oldies cross-country competition have been promised a treasure trove of prizes for simply crossing the finish line. A pretty good deal.
Yes, they're going to be given heart medicines and Viagra, I hope in that order, when they finish the race. What can I say, Yugos, except party! Da-da-da.
Somebody who failed to learn from the lesson of the Super Bowl halftime show. Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and, of course, joins me each Saturday at this time. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Tonight, we are the greatest hockey team in the world.
If there's one thing about which the members of the 1980 U.S. Olympic hockey team can agree, it's that in Miracle, the current movie about the team's Olympic triumph, actor Kurt Russell does a fine job of capturing Coach Herb Brooks.
I'm sick and tired of hearing about what a great hockey team the Soviets have. This is your time.
Now go out there and take it.
Kurt Russell is spectacular. Kurt Russell is Herb Brooks.
Does he? He does seem to be true to the Herb Brooks.
I sat next to Herb's son, and Herb's son couldn't believe how much he was like his dad.
That's Mike Arruzioni, who captained the U.S. team that Herb Brooks led to victory over the Russians 24 years ago. Arruzioni scored the winning goal in that game. At a recent preview of Miracle, Arruzioni was joined by his former teammate, Dave Silk, who also praised Russell's performance.
He was so Herb that it was scary. And it wasn't just the props, the costume, you know, the checkered pants.
The wretched slacks. Oh, my gosh.
Hey, wait a minute. That's my wardrobe.
The laughs at his loud pants notwithstanding, Herb Brooks, who was killed in an auto accident last summer, was a no-nonsense coach. One of the most painful scenes in the movie shows Coach Brooks at his most stubborn. The U.S. team has just lollygagged its way through an exhibition draw with the Norwegian national team in Norway, at least as Brooks sees it. When the game ends, the coach orders the U.S. players to stay on the ice and runs them through a series of exhausting drills.
When you pull on that jersey, you represent yourself and your teammates. And a name on the front is a hell of a lot more important than the one on the back. Get that through your head. Again.
Sipping cranberry juice in a lounge around the corner from the theater, Dave Silk remembers the moment when he thought that that night's agony might be about to end.
Yeah, the rink manager was so upset because he wanted to go home. He turned the lights out and he thought that would be enough to get us off the ice, and we skated in the dark. So that was absolutely true to form.
The movie makes the achievement of the 1980 team an enormous event, not only in terms of the hockey game, but in terms of its symbolic value to the American public at large. Is it a hard thing to grow out of when something that exciting happens? You're at the center of something that big, as you say, at such a young age. Is it hard to grow away from it?
In some ways, it's almost, it can become difficult to get past. You know, for a lot of guys, I think they would have loved to have just been able to play hockey at the next level without the burden of being one of the Americans on that team. You know, it's a double-edged sword. On one hand, I think it opened a lot of doors for us. On the other hand, you know, we became known as the guys from that Olympic team, the Miracle team. So, I think that, you know, it's made me realize that monumental events don't come along that often. And, you know, 20-some-odd years later, to be sitting and watching a movie or to be at Salt Lake City lighting the torch or to be on the cover of a Wheaties box, you know, things that never in your wildest dreams would you have thought would ever happen to you, and here it is, you know. And the event has legs. It has legs.
As the movie suggests, sometimes with all the subtlety of a cross-check in the crease, the defeat of the older, more experienced, thoroughly professional Russian hockey team by a group of talented but young U.S. players was generally regarded as more than a terrific hockey game. Screenwriter Eric Guggenheim subscribes absolutely to the theory that on the Lake Placid ice that night, pluck beat humorless dedication and righteousness hammered tyranny. I wondered, given the baggage that the game carried 24 years ago and has never shed, whether Dave Silk, who went on to play for several years in the National Hockey League, had had much contact with any of the bad guys.
I never had any contact with them of any substance. I played against Krutoff in Switzerland at the end of his career after he had been in Vancouver briefly. I played against Fedosov some. The one moment that I remember best about meeting up with the Soviets was A few years back, we were on the Today Show in New York. I guess it was because I think it was when we were going out to Salt Lake City for the Olympics, but and Fetisov was there as well, and we all had our gold medals, and Fetisov brought out what looked like a drawer from his bureau filled with gold medals, silver medals, you know, every type of medal, you know, Croix de Guerre, Congressional Medals of Honor, you know, I mean, it was just this, it was like machines at the carnival where you could reach in with the claw and take out a bunch of medals.
Whenever you were lucky enough to grab.
Yeah, and he said, well, you know, these are my medals, and, you know, and we all kind of looked at each other and said, boy, did we sneak one by there.
Dave Silk is currently a managing director at Bear Stearns Asset Management in Boston. Mike Ruzioni is the director of development for athletics at Boston University, but he takes some time off in the afternoon to help coach the Winthrop High School boys hockey team. Miracle, the movie, opened yesterday in theaters across the country.
Slap shot goes in!
Dropping gloves and planting flags. Nobody thought the U.S. was able until Mike Ruzioni won the moon.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for the Only a Game newsletter or maybe view photos of the Boston Indoor Games, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from 1980 U.S. Olympic hockey team member and Dr. Seuss fan, Dave Silk. Okay.
So arguably, you could probably say that the guys that played the hockey players might have been better hockey players than the hockey players that played in Lake Placid.
I like the scene in Miracle when the Beatles fight these battles in a bottle with their paddles and the bottles on a poodle and the poodles eating noodles. I also like the scene where Dave Silk is bilked out of the milk by those of questionable ilk. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. Sorry, Dr. Seuss. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.